This is an ABC podcast.
The ACCC finds a short supply of rental properties in regional Australia is leaving the market ripe for property scammers.
The combination of a housing shortage plus the use of COVID as an excuse why people can't visit has just made this a scammer's delight.
And the discovery of aerial photographs of the Kimberley create a rare record of what traditional Aboriginal burning looks like. We're going to take you there.
It just makes me feel good to be working on the same soil that our ancestors was on. Breaking up those sites where you can, like all the old water holes and gillies, and it feels good. I just feel like we sort of took off where they left off, you know.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide. A push to the bush during the coronavirus pandemic and a shortage of affordable housing has contracted the housing market in many pockets of regional Australia. For many Australians, the housing market is getting harder to get into, especially for those looking for a rental. The ACCC says this pressure cooker has created the perfect storm for scammers. They say many desperate people have been caught out by fake rentals advertised on social media. The scammers demand rent in advance and use COVID as an excuse to prohibit potential renters from viewing the property. Renee Duffield's parents' property in Horsham in Western Victoria was one of those, and as she told Rebecca Lowe, they found out their house was being advertised by a rental scammer when someone turned up at the doorstep.
A woman, we don't know who she is because she keeps changing her name, was advertising my parents' house rent, which they've been there for 7 years. And they've had a couple of people turn up to their place asking to have a look through, saying that it's for rent and that they got shown the evidence of this woman advertising it. But yeah, they're not planning on leaving at all. I was actually at my parents' place when a young girl and a woman uniting care worker rocked up to have a look at the house. And my stepdad actually said, well, this is actually a commission house and it's not up for rent. I seen another post of the person that actually runs the Facebook group. She put up a post with my parents' address on it saying that it's a scam. And then I put up a little post saying that it's my parents' place and it's not up for rent. They've been there for 7 years. They don't plan on leaving, and that I apologise to the people that were being basically subjected to the scamming. The person that actually was in coherence with this other person that was like wanting to rent the house, she actually went to the police, and the police are actually doing an investigation at the moment.
The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission has had almost 190 complaints about rental scammers just this year alone. That's more than last year during the pandemic. Delia Rickard is the deputy chair of the ACCC.
Oh, it's been happening right around the country. The ACCC's had nearly 190 reports about rental scams so far this year, which is even more than we had for a longer period during the COVID times last year. So the combination of a housing shortage plus the use of COVID as an excuse why people can't visit has just made this a scammer's delight. One of the very successful scams was somebody who pretended to be a Swedish doctor who had a really nice apartment in Canberra. I particularly know about this because my daughter almost fell for it. And it was not too good to be true, but a really competitive rate. Great pictures of it, reviews, said, you know, you need to pay, I think it was a two-month deposit. But, you know, I can't be there to show you because of COVID. I can't travel to Australia. And so they're using all kinds of excuses not to actually be there and show you through and to therefore get you to put down a deposit quickly because they'll tell you there's lots of competition. And I should warn people too, they're also fishing for your personal information. And, you know, think about what information you give anyone in any circumstances, and there's no reason why these people are going to need your driver's license and all those sorts of things. They find an attractive-looking apartment or house. They take the pictures off the web and then they build their ads around that. And so a bit like you, the person where you were just playing and what happened to her parents, which is obviously a disconcerting thing for a terrible thing for them. If you've paid a deposit and if you figure out very quickly, let your bank know ASAP if you've done this. And if you've given them banking records, really make sure, you know, always let your bank know when you think you've been the victim of a scam. The majority are probably from overseas, but I'm confident we've got a few homegrown ones as well. So it is worth telling the police, and particularly if there's a suspicion that it's a local scammer. There is no bottom for scammers. They will go to any level of lowness.
Rebecca Lowe reporting there from Horsham in Western Victoria.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Sinead Mangan. When the federal budget is revealed tonight, many in Northern Australia will be looking to Treasurer Josh Frydenberg to explain how his government's bold intervention into the cyclone insurance market is going to drive down premiums for small businesses, homeowners and strata title holders. The Prime Minister last week announced a reinsurance pool to cover cyclone and related flood damage in Northern Australia from July next year, and it was backed by a $10 billion guarantee. But unfortunately for primary producers, it won't ease escalating premiums on farms. And that's for those who can actually find a policy, because most insurers don't offer crop protection. In far north Queensland, where some farmers are still recovering from the most recent natural disaster, Tropical Cyclone Nyrin, in March, the ongoing vulnerability has one peak lobby group promoting a model they'd see farmers funding their own insurance cover. Charlie McKillop reports.
The one we're in now in particular is ironically the one we suffered less damage in, and it's the only one that's insured because it's under 5 years old. We had palm fronds dropping on one end from the hedgerow behind, and we had them actually rolling a full 70 metres and dropping off at the other end of the shade. A lot of the shade, the deep shade, was simply blown straight off, straight into the creek or on top of another shade house, which then damaged that shade house. And basically those shade houses are all going to need to have that shade replaced.
Adrian Hawkins is the manager here at Mad About Plants, a sprawling and until recently thriving wholesale and retail plant nursery south of Cairns. Coming through his first cyclone was nerve-wracking enough, without the added anxiety of knowing almost none of this critical infrastructure, nor the precious plants being propagated and grown here, could be insured even if the owner wanted to.
This foliage area here, we've got a lot of plants, a lot of calatheas, a lot of philodendrons, aglaonemas, which are all beautiful foliage colours, a whole array of foliage patterns from climbers, real tropical area, which is really what's in vogue at the moment in Australia wide. And the object is that shade gives us that really nice colour. If we lose that shade, we end up with a lot of burn on the crop, and look, a lot of the crop goes pale, and it's just not that pick-upable for your average gardener. They want to see something really spectacular in their garden. We send things down to Melbourne, and you can't send anything down with a blemish because they'll send it back.
How big a setback is this to your production?
It's quite major, because we do a lot of contract growing for southern nurseries, because they basically stop growing probably about mid-May, and they don't really start growing their foliage until mid-September to October. So we fill that gap in between. And we were really well geared up for that this year with the volume of product we have on the ground, and the product was looking really spectacular. So these next 4 months are probably our biggest months in terms of foliage sales. We have repaired this tunnel. Basically, we had a big 4 metre gap in the shade here, and we've literally had to sew it together as a temporary fix just to protect the crop inside that house. The value of the stock under here is probably $750,000 worth of stock to my customer. You can imagine, for a company as well, to have that gap in basically in the costs that everybody's incurred in terms of potting, pots, compost, plants, which all come from tissue culture, the costs would have been phenomenal. But so it would have been a double whammy. You'd lose your sales, and you would have already spent that money as well. So you probably find the costs, if in the worst case scenario, it'd have been in the millions probably. It was pretty devastating, particularly on this tree area and the palm area. We've got one bay, which is a capacity of 1,800, 400 mil street trees. And basically every single tree in that area was blown over, and the strapping of the support structures was all broken or stretched and unusable. And if you times that by about six, because we've got another six street tree bays, you really begin to understand the damage and just that we could have been overawed by it, but luckily we just did it.
It's taken 2 months for the National Disaster Relief funding arrangements to finally kick in. Now primary producers can access grants of up to $75,000 to assist with their recovery. It's why the Queensland Farmers Federation has been looking at other ways for farmers to fund their own insurance. The Federation's Kerry Battersby says the proposed discretionary mutual fund is the best way for farmers to manage their risk and protect their livelihoods from the impact of natural disasters.
I think the beauty of this particular model is you can get paid out within 14 days. So you're not waiting around for government Category C or Category D activations, which unfortunately can take weeks, if not months and months. And I think that's probably the most important point in this, because, you know, farmers do wake up the next morning. They live on site. They look at the catastrophe every single minute of the day, and it can cause so much stress and anxiety, and it's their livelihood. So we have to look at the vulnerabilities that exist on their property and enable farmers to take control of these risks and vulnerabilities.
What is the cost of that lack of protection to agriculture and to the Queensland economy generally?
It's not just an economic cost, because you look at the damage that's caused from Cyclone Niren recently. It's many, many millions in terms of crop development and supply chain impact, but it's also a mental health cost. It's the cost of the future of the agriculture sector. We all eat food, whether we're living in the city or in a regional or a rural location, and we really need to support them in their daily efforts to produce, you know, valuable food, fibre and foliage.
Why should the Queensland government get involved in a market that the insurance industry itself has, up until this point, proven unwilling to enter?
Well, we're not necessarily asking the Queensland government to get involved, but it's almost a facility to kickstart a fund. So it's about enabling the farmers and supporting the agriculture sector that is so critical to the Queensland economy. We've investigated this. There's been a lot of research done over the last 4 years through University of Southern Queensland and with our insurance partners, Willis Towers Watson, to really look at the models. And we think we've come up with a model that is suitable for Queensland and also especially suitable for Northern Queensland.
Queensland Farmers Federation Disaster Management Program Manager Kerry Battersby ending that story from Charlie McKillop.
Cameron Duncan, Community Kimberley, Australia wide originate Mangan. My name is Cameron Duncan. My language is Mangana. My home is Luma Community in the Kimberleys. My grandparents walked from the Great Sandy Desert. You are now listening to Australia wide with Sinead Mangan.
It's well known that Aboriginal people traditionally use fire to manage their country, to help with hunting and to protect culturally important places. But a lot of knowledge of exactly how fire was used was lost when Aboriginal people were taken off their country or moved into towns and missions. But some aerial photographs of remote parts of the Kimberley were discovered recently, and they were taken shortly after World War II to help plan new mining projects. But as Ben Collins reports, they've created a rare record of what traditional Aboriginal burning really looked like.
We're going to make our way to Site 8. We're going to check them up.
That's Garajari Ranger Kamal Bangu explaining the day's work as we drive through some dense acacia scrub, banging against the car and listening to reggae tunes in the Great Sandy Desert, about 200 kilometres southeast of Broome. The focus for today is measuring how wildlife is responding to the burning program the rangers have been conducting for the last 7 years.
This is one of those sites where we had to do a bit of burn and just to see what we get, what sort of species we get, and sort of like that good two-way learning from scientists and traditional knowledge. And the effect of the fire for our sites we'll be doing, our biodiversity stuff.
That's head Garajari Ranger Braden Bayo-Taylor. The rangers have teamed up with scientists, including ecologist Hamsini Bijlani, and the early results are that the smaller, cooler fires the rangers have been lighting benefit the huge variety of snakes and reptiles living here in the desert.
We're seeing the importance of maintaining a diversity of different fire ages in an area, because, you know, some animals really do like that long, unburnt stuff, but some animals might like stuff that was burnt a few years ago.
While the research is showing the Indigenous Rangers burning program has benefited animals and plants in the desert, the discovery of a rare record of traditional Gurradjuri burning is showing even more can be done. A huge program of aerial photography in 1947 was intended to support new mining projects in remote areas to kickstart the Australian economy after World War II. But some of the black and white images of the Great Sandy Desert have striking patterns crisscrossing the landscape like giant Japanese calligraphy. It was a time when Gurradjuri people were still living on the land, and the patterns show the incredible intricacy of the fire scars left from traditional Indigenous burning. Fire researcher Ed Blackwood analysed the 70-year-old photographs to better understand how fire was used.
I mean, there's nowhere else in Australia or even probably the world where we got this first-hand look at what fire scars were like from this perspective, when traditional people were still living on country and still doing traditional management techniques. Extremely intense level of fire management. I mean, it's people living on this country every single day, burning pretty much every single day so they could, you know, get food, look after their cultural sites, meet up with other people. And so if you're living out on this landscape and just burning as you go, it's obviously a very intense form of work and fire management going on.
Replicating the complex tangle of small fires seen across remote desert country in the old photographs presents a modern challenge to the Gurradjuri people, who mostly live in the coastal community of Bidjadanga and seaside towns like Broome. But Gurradjuri land and sea manager Ewan Noakes believes that part of the answer lies in helping Gurradjuri people get back to country.
I've been working with Indigenous people for a long time now, and part of everyday life is hunting, and with hunting comes fire. You know, one of the things that we've talked about with the rangers and the old people in Bidjadanga is opening up access to the desert so people can just get in their car and have a reasonably good road and access the desert with your family to go camping, hunting and enjoy the place.
Watching Bayo and the other Gurradjuri rangers set fire to Spinifex clumps along the red dirt track, you can see the old photos have reassured them that their work has made a start on continuing their ancestors' ancient practice of managing the desert.
It just makes me feel good to be working on the same soil that our ancestors was on, getting to the places and all these, breaking up those sites where you can, like all the old water holes and gillies, and it feels good. I just feel like we sort of took off where they left off, you know.
Head Gurradjuri Ranger Braden Bio Taylor. He was chatting there to Ben Collins. And if you do have some time, do check out the photos and aerial footage in Ben Collins' online story. Just do a search for ABC and Desert Burn and you'll find it. And there's really amazing photos there of places that we rarely get to see in person.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
They've terrorised our poor sheep. They've terrorised our peacocks, chased away all our chickens.
Yeah, it's been a bit hectic. they're reasonably commonish as far as snakes go here around the resort.
On ABC Radio.
Let's head to Albany now in southern Western Australia, where its respiratory clinic is in full swing, vaccinating people from COVID-19. The respiratory clinic is federally funded, but from next Monday, more GP clinics around the country will start to immunise those over 50 with the AstraZeneca vaccine. It's part of the government's plan to try and fast-track the vaccination programme. So whether you're in line to get it next week or you're still waiting, what's it actually like to get the vaccine? Our reporter, Tim Wong-Si, popped in to chat to those in line for the jab.
Hello, how are you going?
Good.
What's your name? And you're feeling well today?
Yeah.
Any cold or flu symptoms at all? Any recent travel in the Perth or Peel region?
It's a Friday afternoon at this COVID vaccine clinic in Albany.
Is that a mask you have with you there?
Can
do you mind? Yeah, just a precaution.
Oh, we can go without it.
About 15 people are sitting under a marquee waiting to get their shot of the AstraZeneca vaccine. There's a 2.5 hour window that people have booked themselves into, and the man in charge is Dr. James Turner.
It's a typically busy clinic with about 8 patients every 15 minutes kind of rolling through. It's set up in our marquee where we have our drive-through clinic in the morning. So in the afternoon it gets converted into a vaccine clinic.
Whether it's the hope of getting international travel back again or just protection against COVID symptoms, everyone has their own reasons for getting vaccinated. Judy Bremers travelled from Walpole, about an hour and a half west of Albany.
When I get my second vaccine, I'll feel like a bit more comfortable moving around the community and not so concerned if someone's, you know, I don't know, is standing near me, and because you mostly know every, you know, a lot of people in Walpole, and when you see strangers, you sort of, oh, are they down from Perth or what's that sort of thing.
For people like Judy who are keen to get vaccinated, it's the work of people like Bonnie Dewar who can make it happen.
Possible side effects from the vaccination down the side here. Have you had your flu vaccination yet? It was more than 2 weeks ago. Beautiful. Practice phone.
She's one of the nurses and is one of the two people who are immunising people at this clinic.
I feel it's an important part to get this vaccination out into the world so the world can get back to normal as much as we can now with this new virus around.
How do you view what's happening around the world right now?
I feel very sorry for the countries that it's gone rife in, and hopefully doing our part we can get it all under control across the world.
Okay.
So this is our fridge that we store our pre-drawn up vaccines in. We just have an ampoule in here at the moment.
So just tell me what that was.
So this is an ampoule with 10 doses of the COVID vaccination in it. It's an unopened ampoule for when we need to draw it up.
And how big would you say that vial is?
That vial is 5 mils. Yeah, so half a mil for each patient.
So you could probably fit 5 of them just in the palm of your hand.
Yeah. So they need to be well looked after, even though they're little. Fully temperature controlled, so we can guarantee that it is in perfect range when we're using it.
And what temperature are we at here now?
We are at 5.7 at the moment, which is perfectly where it should be sitting.
Okay. What's the upper threshold of that temperature that it can...
8. 8's the maximum it can get to, which over that we can't guarantee that it's a good vaccine, so we have strict controls and it's documented exactly what it is at all times.
Everyone who's lined up to get vaccinated has also weighed up the risks, especially with the headlines about developing rare blood clots after getting the vaccine. 71-year-old Libby Wynn is getting vaccinated and the issue was on her mind, but not for long.
When I heard about the blood clots, I spent about 48 hours thinking about it, and then I thought, no, just get the job done. It's the best we're going to get. Nothing else is, who knows when the Pfizer or the other ones are going to get here, so just get something. And by the time the Pfizer gets here, I might be due for a booster, I don't know.
What convinced you that you wanted to get it?
I just got over the slight shock and I thought, look, one in 200,000 is pretty long odds. I'm 71, so hopefully at lower risk, and I do need to go to Perth occasionally to see my family, so I thought I'll feel a lot. I just thought it'll be give me more peace of mind if I've had it done.
And James Turner says while doctors like himself have a big job, people can decide for themselves.
We know more and more about this rare complication which can occur with this vaccine. There was some hesitancy, I think, and the vaccine clinic numbers dropped off, but it's now quite busy again. The clinics for the next 10 days are fully booked. And as a GP, I guess our role is just to present them the information as accurately and also knowing a little bit about their background health problems, we can give some advice and then people make their own minds up about it.
Dr. James Turner from Pioneer Health in Albany in Western Australia, and he was chatting there to Tim Wong-Si. Now, Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg will soon release his third budget aimed to bolster Australia's economy as the nation recovers from the coronavirus pandemic. The budget is expected to reveal a significant improvement to the bottom line due to soaring iron ore prices and a stronger than expected bounce back in the job markets. And to remind you of the announcements already made, there's been $1 billion to train and reskill the unemployed young people and school leavers, $1.7 billion in a childcare package, a $1.2 billion scheme to grow the digital economy, $10 billion for infrastructure over the next 10 years, and a scheme to help single parents buy property. Now, there are more significant announcements expected tonight around aged care, mental health and women's safety. And for extensive coverage of the budget, stay listening to ABC Radio. And that's all from Australia Wide for tonight. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you have a lovely evening. Cheerio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.